Jacqueline Mendes, who's at the University of Leicester. And her talk is Banned Feminism, Promotional Culture and Contemporary Feminist Activism.
Sorry, I'm another one. I sort of changed the title towards the last minute. But anyways, it's not too far off. So again, hi everyone, thanks so much for having me, and like everyone said before, it's been a wonderful day, and thank you for inviting me, and I've been inspired by everything that I've heard today, and I think if I could do it again, there are certain changes that I would make to the presentation to kind of really speak to some of the issues that have been brought up, but my talk will actually follow very closely on from yours, so that I think is like a very good ordering and pairing. Okay, so the order of what I'm going to do today, I'm going to start off by telling you a little bit about the background, how I got interested in this topic, because it's a slight departure from my normal research area, which is kind of representations of feminist activism and mostly recently engagement with digital feminist activism. And I've recently become interested in this kind of issue of branding of feminism. Okay, I'm going to then tell you a little bit about social movement theories, which have informed my work. Also, a little bit about neoliberalism, feminism, and the market. And then I'm going to hopefully spend most of the presentation by outlining what I'm terming like a new theoretical framework for trying to understand contemporary, particularly grassroots feminist activism. But these practices also take place in kind of more formalized NGOs as well. Okay, so the background. I never intended to study branding or marketing theories. But over the past few years, like I say, my research first started examining representations of feminist activism in the media, and then the way that feminist activists were using social media to engage in activism and represent themselves. This concept of branding was something that I'd come across several different times throughout various interviews over the years that I've done with feminists, but I never really thought much about it. For example, it's been said for many years that because of feminism's negative reputation, feminism needs a makeover, it needs to be rebranded. So, I mean, that's a concept that's been around for, or it's a debate, a discussion that's been around for a long time. But the idea and the link, I suppose, really crystallized when I heard about something called the Amber Rose Slut Walk. So just to start, by show of hands, how many of you have heard of the Slut Walk? Okay, so most people in the room. For those of you who don't, it's an anti-rape and anti-victim-blaming movement. It's a grassroots movement that kind of swept the world starting in Canada in 2011. 3 years ago, there's an American celebrity named Amber Rose. Hands up if you know who Amber Rose is. Okay, so she's an actress, she's a model, she's a reality television host. She's the host of a well-known podcast called Loveline. She was quite famous for dating Kanye West, and he ultimately slut-shamed her when they broke up by saying he had to take like 1,000 showers, implying she was very dirty. So Amber Rose, 3 years ago, started hosting the highly branded Amber Rose Slut Walk. So it's not just the Slut Walk, it is the Amber Rose Slut Walk. And you can see an image there, very kind of slick, and very much in contrast to other slut walks, which, so I wrote a book about slut walks, so I was very familiar with the movement. So I'd never seen anything quite like this before within contemporary feminist activism. So it was very stylized, professionalized, and branded with a celebrity attached to it. Okay, so this is another poster for the 2017 March. So like I say, I've been aware of slut walks since they first started in 2011, but in the fall of 2017, slightly earlier than that, when I went to the website, because I teach a class in my lecture every year about the slut walks, so I went to the website to just kind of get some more information about it, and I was blown away by even the transformations within the Amber Rose slut walk. Because it transformed from what I would describe as an activist website to a marketing website. So, for example, the website had very little about the march itself, but a lot about how vendors, sponsors, why they should become involved. There was a 16-page marketing pack that I went and read through. So it talks about how the Amber Rose Slut Walk secured a top marketing and branding PR firm to integrate and implement your corporate agenda and brand's objectives. And they talk about different reasons why, you know, you should invest and partner with the Amber Rose Slut Walk. it will distinguish you from the crowd and leverage your brand to build relationships with your customers. The Amber Rose Slutwalk brand is fluid enough to connect with various types of audience in different marketing venues across demographics. You know, enhance your corporate reputation by aligning yourself with a hip, young, and ambitious brand that supports social justice issues and empowerment. So again, the website was mostly geared toward attracting vendors with a little bit of kind of activism on the side. So it had this very clearly laid out marketing and PR strategy, and points out that it hired the PR company not just to organize the march and a women's conference, which took place the day before, but it talks explicitly about the Amber Rose brand and why sponsors should invest in it. So the Amber Rose Slutwalk is really the catalyst for my interest, but when I look back at other popular campaigns that I've been studying in recent years, such as Holla Back, Everyday Sexism, even recently Me Too and Time's Up, I can actually start to make connections about the logics of marketing and promotional culture and how I can see patterns, okay, that are being adopted across the activists themselves, but which I haven't really found much scholarship on or public discussion about. So before I kind of lay out my framework, I want to take you through some current conceptual models for how we currently study social movements, so I can maybe start to point out some gaps. And I want to start with kind of just general comments about social movement theory. So Marx and Engels once claimed that all history is a record of struggle between the powerless and the powerful. So social movement theory, for those of you who aren't that familiar with it, is interested in understanding how the powerless and the disenfranchised, or those with the cause, okay, so how do they gain power? How do they communicate their values and beliefs and ideas? So it's also a study of why social mobilization occurs, its various characteristics, and its impact. So as a field, social movement studies really began in around the 19th century. And at the start, people were interested in, for example, what made people join in collective action. And you know, up until about the 1960s, key theories emerged, such as kind of mass society theory, relative deprivation theory, structural strain theory, value-added theory. But in the 1960s, we really start to see a shift in some of the theorization. So we see kind of the development of new social movement theory and resource mobilization theory. We've also seen kind of the cultural turn, so thinking about kind of the role of culture and emotion and affect. So there's lots of kind of really exciting developments within social movement theory. But I want to talk a little bit about resource mobilization theory, because this is sort of where some of my own initial interest in social movements began, and maybe also where I can start to see a place where I can make a contribution. So resource mobilization theory thinks about resources which must be mobilized, how social movements are linked to other groups, how much they depend on external sources for support, what tactics they use, how they kind of interact with various authority figures, etc. So within resource mobilization theory, we can maybe think about mobilization structures, opportunity structures, and also framing processes. So framing was one of the key theories that I'd always engaged with before when I was looking at representations of feminism in the mainstream media. So it's the extent to which the movement's message about itself and the issues which are at stake and how to overcome them, how social movements communicate these to the wider public. And so for me, framing has always been a really useful tool because it takes into account culture and emotions, okay, which I think are very important, and at getting people to effectively connect with the cause. So I could say more about kind of these different approaches, but for the sake of time, I'm not going to elaborate too much. But I will say something briefly about framing, which again has been quite key for me. So scholars have historically studied the way that social movements frame themselves in order to create meaning and value and target the public. So it's often been used by social movements to set the agenda and to convince people of why the movement is necessary and why they should join. And of course, this is extremely important. So I'm not saying that framing as a concept or a tool is not without value. Okay, I definitely think it's value. Only what I'm arguing is that we need to understand how framing, this is my argument, is increasingly being shaped by the logics of promotional culture. So this is sort of why I'm making my own intervention. So while framing has historically been a tool used to better understand social movements, I suggest, and this is where I need some feedback, that these processes may be better understood as branding, as my research suggests that they are underpinned by the logics from marketing and promotional culture. So quite controversial, hopefully thought-provoking. And so I'm suggesting that within social movement theory, we may need to move beyond simple frame analysis to understand contemporary social movements and the way that they create meaning and value for the public, and recognize the ways that existing social movement practices are increasingly taking into account the logics from promotional culture and marketing and branding. Okay, I'll come back to this in a little bit. So moving away slightly from social movement theory, feminist scholars have also been increasingly attuned to the impact of neoliberalization and the market and the impact it's had on feminism. And we've heard a lot about this from scholars today, so I'm not going to go into too much depth. But we have terms such as commodity feminism, coined by Robert Goldman, but also used by Brené Weiser and McRobbie. I love, Jemima, your feminist commodity activism. That's one that I'm going to have to add to the list. We've heard about power femininity, so how women are expected to purchase items as a sign of their power and independence. We've talked about the neoliberalization of feminism, so Catherine, your work has been hugely influential there. We've seen others talk about the shift from state feminism to market feminism, so where corporations take over issues that have previously been taken up by activists or NGOs, and this has sometimes been called the corporatization of activism. And so it's this last theory, for example, it's relevant to what I'm talking about today, but it doesn't explain everything that what I'm seeing within feminist activism, particularly those that's operating on a grassroots level, volunteers, people who don't have regular sources of funding or income. So I'm not just arguing that corporations are taking over feminism, although they are, and we can see that very clearly kind of from the last presentation. Or that they're just trying to use feminism as part of their marketing. So I'm approaching this from the other way around. I'm not looking at it from the top down, how these corporations are co-opting feminism, for example. I'm looking at how feminists, grassroots feminists, are adopting the logic of marketing and promotional culture into the activism themselves. So I'm proposing a theory which takes into account Mukherjee and Brené Weiser's argument that in our contemporary society, it's very difficult for activism to operate outside the logic of neoliberal capitalism. Okay, but despite this, I argue that there's been little critical attention to the way that activists, particularly those at grassroots level, are engaging with these corporate neoliberal logics, and especially on a macro level. We can see on a micro level people engaging with things such as the professionalization of activism, or the corporatization of activism, but kind of looking at a range of practices that are going on and trying to unpack them. So, specifically, I found very little research on social movements' relationship with capitalism or market logic, so on this holistic level. So, here's my proposal. So, I propose that as neoliberalism continues to gain global dominance, we need a new theoretical framework in which to understand the relationship between activism, promotional culture, and social change. And this, for me, is because dominant theories such as framing or resource mobilization, they don't quite capture the nuances of relevant practices that I see going on amongst activists. So I'm tentatively calling this framework brand feminism, and it attends to the ways that feminist activists are drawing on these promotional cultural strategies to brand their activism. And when I'm talking about branding, I'm talking about invoking experiences that create affective ties. So it's the making and selling of immaterial things, so feelings and affect and personalities and values, rather than necessarily goods. Okay, although, as we saw again with Jemima, it is sometimes also goods as well. And I think that this, from my own ethnographic, in-depth study of feminist activism, I think this is what a lot of them are doing. And so brand feminism is tied up with other practices within promotional culture. So branding, okay, is of course important, but I also see processes of commercialization, professionalization, something I'm calling social change franchising, glocalization, and the increased use of celebrity icons. So I need to kind of preface this framework by stating that I am not suggesting that all feminist campaigns or organizations adhere to all of these tactics, so kind of make that very clear from the start. And nor am I suggesting that these processes are necessarily new. So I'm going to refer to your presentation again throughout, but some of these processes have been refined over the years, in part with the help of digital technologies, which speed up or simplify these processes and help build affective ties that are needed to give value to the brand. I'm also not suggesting that in creating a brand, financial capital is the sole aim of these feminist activist campaigns. So in some cases, yeah, they're trying to make money, but in I would say most of the cases that I'm talking about, they really do want to, they want to foster wider structural social change. But I am arguing that this framework contributes to arguments which show that contemporary feminist activism is not only informed by, but steeped within the logic of neoliberal capitalism, promotional culture, marketing, and branding. Okay, and perhaps, you know, to many of us in the room, that's not a surprise. So when thinking about this, what this framework does, I'm suggesting that we should study social movements with an eye towards social change, franchises, commodification, merchandising, professionalization, and the use of celebrity icons. So these are kind of different aspects of the framework that I'm developing. So I'm just going to very quickly start with the notion of branding itself. I've already kind of mentioned it, but branding is about the making and selling of these immaterial things. So it can be products, but it can also be feelings and affects. And you know, there's a lot of recent literature that talks about how brands trade on affect, and successful brands create these affective ties between the marketer and the consumer. So in this case, feminist organizers or campaigns, they want to sell to the public the idea that feminism is necessary, okay, that we live in an unequal society and that we need to do something to change this. Branding often involves the creation of visual signifiers, such as logos, mottos, taglines, and spokespeople. And Yemayba has already just talked about this in her presentation, looking at the suffragettes, for example, who created, you know, banners, teacups, jewelry, lots of different things. So this idea that social movements create a distinct and identifiable symbols is absolutely nothing new. So branding is not new, but I argue that it's become intensified with the rise of neoliberalism and opportunities for visibility within this landscape that's afforded by new media technologies. So with the rise of social media and the potential for social movements to gain greater visibility, they are acutely aware of the importance of visual symmetry and cohesion. So as a result, it's increasingly common for participants at marches that I've been attending to, feminist marches, to be given pre-made banners, for example, or placards, or even paraphernalia. I've been given free t-shirts at different marches, or balloons, or badges, just things. So that when you're on the march and everyone's there with their cameras or the news media is there taking picture, you can see some sort of visual coherence, and you can see perhaps, you know, the name of the organization who's hosting it, their branding, their name is very visible. So, in my experience, feminist marches and events are becoming more uniform in their look. And this is both at the grassroots and more formalized events, so those organized by NGOs. So, for example, in 2017, I attended the March for Women in London, where they were handing out these home, you know, these pre-made placards to everyone. And it was really significant that when you looked at the media coverage, you see the sea of orange. Okay, so, you know, people obviously did bring their own homemade placards. You can see them there. But the vast majority of people were seen carrying kind of these March for Women placards. So this is quite strategic. So no, CARE, this is like a very well-known global NGO. They have the resources to be able to afford to kind of print this off. You know, perhaps it's not surprising to see it with them. But when I attended the Amber Road Slut Walk in the fall, when I showed up early in the morning the first day, same thing. There was a whole table of different pre-made placards that one could pick up and bring with them on the march. And again, it's interesting here because quite a few of them have the Amber Rose Slut Walk brand on them. But even if not, we can see that there's a range of different signs, but it's quite significant that the march itself was giving out these placards to people as well. I was also given free t-shirts, and this was a march where, you know, there was tons of paraphernalia that was being donned out, so that when the photo opportunities came about, there was a streamlined look. So this streamlined look isn't unique or limited just to the marches themselves, but it's also to a feminist campaign social media and websites. So this is actually two screenshots. So Holla Back, it's an anti-street harassment organization. So the first one is the most up-to-date screenshot of what the Holla Back website looks like. And here is a screenshot of Holla Back Alberta. So we can see that obviously, it's the same logo, there's a lot of symmetry. So even when you go to kind of the different satellite sites, there's visual symmetry there. And it's quite significant here as well because, again, Holla Back, this is a nonprofit organization, but I can see similar trends even within grassroots organizations. So the Global Slutwalk Movement has no central headquarters. And when I interviewed the co-founder of Slutwalk, so not the Amber-Rose Slutwalk, but the Slutwalk, several years ago, she told me that she didn't see herself in charge of the movement. Even though many people who organize slut walks, they reached out to her, she didn't see herself as actually being in charge of the movement. And she didn't want to give other people directives on how they should run their own slut walks. But that didn't mean that there wasn't a culture of the sharing within the movement. So there were several secret Facebook groups that were organized where they regularly shared images and slogos, and information on things like how to write a press release or organize an event. So slut walk, anyone who started their own slut walk could come up with their own branding or logo or design. But actually, if you look across various websites, you can see that there is a uniformity in what they do. So these are perhaps kind of the two main images that I would see, on Twitter, for example. So they would have kind of the main slut walk logo, and then would often insert the local name below it. Or this photo became very popular, Don't Get Raped, and this was often used as kind of the picture image of a lot of the Slutwalk Twitter feeds. Okay, again, these are just a few more images, but we can see again that they're using the same fonts, they're using the same color schemes, and they often use the same taglines and logos and taglines. So one common tagline was Slutwalk, the radical notion that no one deserves to be raped. Okay, so this tagline was used in many, many, many of the different satellite groups. So these are just a few examples of the ways that feminist campaigns use these logos and taglines and fonts and color schemes to create a brand, okay, for their campaign or their feminism. Another process that I'm seeing is the franchising. I'm kind of conceptualizing it as the franchising of feminist initiatives. So within the fields of entrepreneurship and management and marketing, scholars have paid attention to both processes of business format franchising and social entrepreneurship. So when we're talking about franchising, we're talking about the establishment of satellite groups or parallel campaigns in other parts of the world. So with business format franchises, the purpose is to make money. With social entrepreneurship, the goal is to use entrepreneurial activities to instigate some sort of social change. So there is a lot of scholarship on both of these models, but there's actually very little research on kind of the franchising of social change movements, so what I'm calling social change franchising. So in part, it's because these initiatives are not formally registered as businesses or NGOs or charities. They don't leave any paper trails, and they have little to no formal accountability to the public stakeholders. And all franchising, including social change franchising, it relies on having a brand, an established brand, okay, in order to work. So feminists have figured out that, if you want to have a feminist march or something, it's easier to get people to come if you're using a name or a term that people have already heard of. So if you want to start an anti-victim blaming march or an anti-rape march, why not host a slut walk? Or why not host a take back the night march? Okay, so rather than having to reinvent the wheel, they are recreating these initiatives. Okay, so due to time, I'm going to have to really kind of speed up. So one example of what we might consider social change franchise, the Everyday Sexism Project. So this is a British initiative. Some of you may be familiar with it. But you can also, now the project has been translated to many different languages, to different countries. So the one on the top is the Everyday Sexism Project from Brazil. The one on the bottom is from Japan. we can see this kind of social change franchising with campaigns such as Who Needs Feminism, which started as a class project at Duke University in 2012 with the help of UK Feminista. It has spread to over 60 different institutions that have been recorded. So people take a photo of themselves explaining why they need feminism. So franchisees often engage with localization, this concept of think global, act local, to ensure that their movement resonates with local populations and responds to local needs. And I find this really significant. So slut walks, for example, took place in over 200 cities and 40 nations around the world. And speaking with the organizers, they would often translate key terms. Sometimes they would have a parallel translation in a local language like Hindi. And they would also have different aspects maybe of the website that were translated, or they would focus on different goals. So while slut-shaming was a focus in the original march in Toronto, in Bangalore, for example, they talked about eve-teasing, which is a concept which is much more talked about within the Indian context. So I saw that organizers across the world didn't just adopt kind of the Western model. They were engaged with these processes of globalization. Okay, so Jemima just talked about this, but the other thing that we're seeing is commodification. So, you know, we have research that talks about how ideas and practices developed by social movements are frequently taken up by the market and commodified. And, you know, we've seen excellent examples of that. And what I thought was really interesting is that this isn't just done at the corporate level. So this is an image that I took at the Slut Walk in Los Angeles, where a guy was just walking around selling homemade buttons. I asked him where he got them from, and he said him and his buddy just made them in their house, and they were there at the march selling them. If you go into Etsy after the women's marches, where pussy hats were kind of like the very common fashion, you could go and buy your own pussy hat, and they range from about £5 to £50. Okay, so these are what we might call, or I'm tentatively labeling, fempreneurs. I'd love to have a chat with you about it. So enterprising individuals who are capitalizing on feminism's popularity to make money. Perhaps, you know, it's also tied in with their kind of feminist beliefs. Another trend that I'm seeing is the professionalization of activism. And this isn't a new trend. You know, scholars have been talking about this since at least the 1970s. It's making use of people who are paid for their work. But one of the things that I found in my research is that the skills that activists are looking for have shifted. So whereas they previously would look for someone with journalism background or a PR background, increasingly they're looking for people with social media skills who know how to use Twitter, for example. But in addition to that, of course, we can see the paid use of professionals. So the Amber Rose Slut Walk hired the Saks agency. So this is a screenshot of them. And this was really fascinating because there were four paid members of staff who organized this year's Slut Walk, but they also relied on 32 unpaid interns. And, you know, I could speak more about this idea of kind of like hope labor, aspirational labor, because I spoke to a lot of the interns to ask them why, you know, why were they there? Why were they giving up their time? And, of course, they felt passionate about feminism, but also I want to get into a career in events management or marketing and communication. I don't have time to go into more of that. Closely tied with professionalization is corporate sponsorship, okay? The Amber Rose Slut Walk, the title sponsorship went for $75,000. Reebok was the corporate sponsor. Oh, this was so fascinating. I could talk lots about the Amber Rose Slut Walk. You could also buy VIP passes. I didn't buy one, but I was given one. They cost $200, and I got a VIP pass to go into the back. Well, it wasn't in the backstage. It was in the very middle of this court at the Amber Rose Slut Walk. Free booze, free champagne. But I'm really interested into kind of the changing space of activism. So increasingly we see photos like this at the women's marches. What's significant is we see barriers. And we see Jessica Chastain passing out lanyards, presumably for backstage passes at women's marches and events. So I'm really, really interested in this. I don't have time to kind of talk about it. But in this photo as well, look at them. They're all wearing their lanyards that will get them into the backstage area. So we can see kind of these... the spatial dynamic of marches is also changing. Okay, and finally, I'll just say the use of celebrity icons. When I first went onto the website for the March for Women, they tried to attract people to come to the march, not because you care about feminist issues, but because guess which celebrities are going to be there? Mel C of the Spice Girls is going to be there. Bianca Jagg is going to be there. Sadiq Khan's going to be there. Come to the march. And after the march, well, I'm quite proud because This is a screenshot from their website. March for Women. Which famous feminist are you? Take our quiz and find out. So the use of celebrity icons is increasingly a tactic that's being used to draw women and men to attend these feminist events. So I'm not going to finish with a conclusion. Instead, I've got questions, a lot of questions that I'm still working through, and I really welcome your advice on. So how does using neoliberal marketing logics affect the visibility and voice of contemporary feminisms? How does thinking about communication and mobilization in terms of branding affect what social movements or feminist movements can say or do? How is it limiting? How is it constraining? How is it helping? What kinds of movements most succeed in using these branding logics? Because, you know, these are white, middle-class, Western, quite privileged movements that I've been talking about today. How can the processes and logic seen in some of the grassroots feminist movements be applied to other contemporary social movements? Are we at a point where we can talk about brand feminism? Or is this kind of constrained to brand activism? Can we apply it to brand activism, or is this brand feminism? What do we as theorists gain from reframing social movement communication in neoliberal terms? What's there to gain? What's there to lose? How does branding help us better understand the emergence and mobilization and strategic communication practices of social movements? Is branding a form of strategic framing or co-optation? And I wonder myself, in coming up with this framework, am I just capitulating to capitalism by kind of coming up with a fancy new word for maybe processes that have been around for a long time? I welcome feedback on all of this. So thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah.